So I'm going to call the meeting to order and welcome everyone. So this is an open forum organized by the MAUT Ad Hoc Committee on Academic Freedom. I'm just going to take a very few minutes just to set out the background and some of the ground rules. It's hard to anticipate in advance just how much talking people want to do. So if it turns out that there's a lot of conversation to be had, we want to make sure that everyone gets a chance. So I'm going to set out the ground rules. We thought as a starter, as ground rules, that we'll ask people to come forward to the mic and identify themselves, and in addition to limit themselves to 3 minutes. If it turns out, as we'll see when I project the agenda, button down, I assume. Yep, whoops. There we go. So we have an agenda, which was essentially the agenda that was put out in our invitation. So just as a default, we decided to limit discussion for the first set of topics to 15 minutes, and then we have a general discussion period after that for a half hour. What we thought we would do was keep a speaker's list. So if, for example, under the fourth topic, we run out of time, but there's still five people who want to say something, they'll be on a list, and when we come back to the general discussions, we'll give those people a chance to step up to the microphone and express themselves. But I thought this way we'd be sure to make sure that at least all the topics are covered, and then if there's more time and things that have to be elaborated, we'll have that half hour to do that. And then we'll conclude with maybe a 10-minute conclusion. So that's the set of ground rules. So Jane has been kind enough to agree to keep the time. We have a little sign there to say there's 1 minute. And I really would like to keep to time limits. So as I said, you also had the opportunity to send things in. We provided an email address, which I don't have in front of me right now, but we'll provide you with that before we leave. So you also have the further option of sending in emails as well. So if that's relatively clear regarding the ground rules, let me just turn now to a little bit of background. So the background to this was a CAUT meeting that I and Mayor Nahon, who was then a VP External for MAUT, were at, where the question of academic freedom came up. We were voting on some amendments to the, or additions to the CAUT policy on academic freedom. But this was occasioned by the general discussion that was provoked by the AUCC, as a result of the brouhaha surrounding their particular statement, we realized that McGill itself didn't have a statement on academic freedom. So a committee was struck to investigate or to think about that and to come up with proposals. So we've had a committee. They're in front of you here, all of us: Ian Henderson, Jane Aikens, and John Galati, and I. And Dan Siri, yes, thanks. There's Dan. And then with occasional visits from Mark Richard and also Ken Hastings, who will be here a little bit later. But the committee were the people I first mentioned. And we've been looking at various statements of academic freedom, and the idea is that we'll come up with a set of recommendations that we will bring to MAUT, and it'll also be viewed by the general membership. So today what we wanted to make sure that we did is that we heard from people as broadly as possible about the sorts of concerns that people have, because it's very easy to get from your own bailiwick to see things in a very narrow way. And so we were hoping to get as broad a participation as possible in this meeting so that we could get a broader perspective to help inform the kind of general guidelines or the general formulation of an academic freedom statement. And I'm pleased that many of the people that I sent out emails to were kind enough to show up. I appreciate that a lot. I won't go through and acknowledge all the various peoples, but I see them making eye contact with them right now. So without any further ado, let me just now turn to the agenda. So we want to talk about academic freedom within McGill and the issues raised by that, and I thought we'd start just with a 5-minute presentation by Sharon Rankin, just to give you a general idea of how this issue could surface in a faculty as it did among the librarians. So that'll be 5 minutes of that 15 minutes, and then we'll open it to general discussion and ask people to come up and limit themselves to 3 minutes. So you'd be kind enough to take the podium.
Great. Thank you, Brendan, and thank you to the members of the committee for inviting me to provide you some background about librarians' experiences. I'm currently chair of the librarians section this year, representing the librarians. So for those of you who don't know, the librarians section is a section of MAUT. So we're MAUT members, and we're also members of the librarians section. I've been an academic librarian since 1986 here at McGill. What I wanted to provide you with was some examples of threats that we've received in the past. Words and actions from the university administration, the library administration, that have really undermined our academic status at McGill, and we would consider have been attacks on our academic freedom. Our troubles actually really, really began in 2005. Coincidentally, I was also chair of the librarian section at that time. So that's why I'm very close and I know some of the details. The university appointed a director of libraries who came to campus with a very different view of how librarians should perform their academic duties. If you're not aware, we have academic duties defined as position responsibilities, scholarship, and service. So what happened in 5 years of the tenure of the director of libraries, and I'll quote, we had a systematic attempt to control, downgrade, or eliminate librarian scholarship and service. Now, traditionally, in past practice, when I was a librarian prior to 2005, librarians actually had a choice in the areas of scholarship and service that they chose to participate in. When this director arrived on campus, she decided to interpret one of the regulations that governed the assignment of our duties to mean that she was to allocate our position responsibilities, but also what we did in terms of service and scholarship. So for those of you who know the regulations, I can point it out. It's 1.4.2, and it's an allocation statement that perhaps faculty have the same. What I want to tell you is give you some examples of what we viewed as threats to our academic freedom, and I'll just list them all. The director at the time attempted to influence the content of our presentations, the text and our visuals. One of the ways this was done was by stating that the funding to attend a conference would only be contingent on the review of the content of the paper being presented. Librarians were told that they could not engage in scholarly activities without the approval of their supervisor. And if the activity did take place that was unapproved, it could not be used in the dossier for tenure or in the merit consideration. It was suggested to us on many occasions that publications were not an important part of our library career or our work as academic duties at McGill. The director also used her influence to prevent librarians from receiving invitations to present at workshops and seminars, both in the university and outside the university. I myself was a recipient of this policy. In 2005, the School of Information Studies was notified by the director that no guest lecturing opportunities were to be offered to McGill librarians directly. The director wanted to approve all invitations as she knew best who could be a guest lecturer and who would be the best person to teach in the courses. 1 minute? Okay. I have a few more things, so I'll speed along. As you can imagine, the work environment became increasingly tense. Librarians were publicly dressed down, privately criticized if they expressed alternative points of views, both in public and in private. There was an attempt to control email communications. Mark may speak to this, but the Senate summaries, which you all received from the librarian senators, representatives, were controversial at this time, and the director tried to vet the content and alter who received them. Librarians were denied scholarly recognition for their work as curators of library exhibitions. It was not possible to have their name on the intellectual content of their work. The director denied librarians' requests to take university-level courses in areas of librarian specialty. And the director discouraged librarians from being advisors to academic colleagues, suggesting to MAUT advisors that time should not be spent doing this and wanted to approve their work doing this. As well, she refused to allow librarians to accompany them to meetings, have advisors accompany them to meetings. Okay, I've got the hook now, and I'm not quite through it. I just wanted to mention two areas concerning a librarian's choice of research topic. There were librarians who were strongly suggested to change their research topic when they were 2 years away from tenure consideration. Another librarian strongly suggested to change their research topic for a sabbatical leave application. When the librarian didn't change it, the leave was not supported by the director. Librarians were cautioned by the director not to visit other libraries without her notice or approval. And there was intimidation felt by the librarians section concerning governance issues. We received an email asking us to withdraw issues on the floor of Senate. And the executive was told not to conduct a survey of our members to find out how the members felt. So there we go. That's the laundry list from some of the things that were happening in 5 years. I really think that these point to a real attempt to control independent thinking and expression, our freedom to teach and present. It was obstructed and interfered with. And really, our involvement in university governance was impeded. That continues on today as librarians no longer are able to serve on faculty university tenure committees. So in conclusion, we're really hoping that part of the discussion today will lead to some academic freedom statements that are actually part of the regulations, and more than that, some kind of mechanism to help resolve issues, because we don't believe that, we don't really want to go through what we went through for the past 5 to 6 years. Thank you.
So thank you very much, Sharon. So the idea of this is just to get things started. So I see Jonathan. So I don't want to be embarrassed because I recognize faces, but I often forget names. So I'm relying on my colleagues. So if there are other people, please put your hands up and we'll create a speaker's list.
I haven't prepared my 3-minute disquisition. I have a question, which is, librarians can be members of MAUT, right?
Yes.
Yeah? So where was MAUT during all this? What did MAUT do to defend librarians' academic freedom?
So that's an interesting and useful question. Since the point of this is to, the agenda here is to talk about perceived threats to academic freedom across the university, I'd rather focus on that. But if there are no other questions, then I'll be happy to respond to that. But it's not quite the topic that I wanted to address. Okay, so Bruce, you have a question? So, comment, 3 minutes.
Yeah, okay. Thanks. Tony Massey likes to say that with rights come responsibilities, and with the right to academic freedom comes the responsibility of academic integrity. And I don't think the threats to my academic integrity are really for, you know, impingements on my academic freedom. Usually it's temptations which lead me to stray from academic integrity myself. Working on an easy problem where I can get lots of quick papers and get tenure or a merit increase rather than on a harder, more interesting problem. Going to a conference in Hawaii rather than a conference in Sudbury, even though the conference in Sudbury would be more valuable. Working on product development instead of basic fundamental research, because that way I can get consulting money from Microsoft. You know, I think I'm pretty good at telling other people to try and infringe on my freedoms to take a hike. Sometimes I even use more intemperate language. What I'm not so good at is keeping my hand out of the cookie jar, and I have to watch for that. And I think the same thing holds for McGill. Right? I think McGill is a big, powerful institution. It's pretty good at using its institutional autonomy to protect itself from outside forces like funding agencies, donors, corporations. What it's not so good at, you know, even well-intentioned administrators who are trying to keep a boat afloat on a stormy sea may, you know, succumb to temptation to do something which impinges on academic freedom. They may accept money from corporations which has inappropriate restrictions on the governance. They may They may fire somebody with tenure before they find out what's really going on because they want to protect McGill's reputation. They may impose a top-down hierarchical administration in the interest of efficiency rather than ensuring that there's really a democratic collegial governance so that academics can make sure the academic mission is respected. You know, so you and Ian and Mark and Joseph and I all went down to Toronto last week, and we heard from the people in the trenches defending academic freedom their war stories. And story after story after story, it was the same. The universities were the villains of the piece, and academic freedom was only protected by collective, collaborative action by faculty members. And and I think that's what we have to think about. Academic freedom isn't about all of these external people that you've got here. That's institutional autonomy. You know, academic freedom is about internal fights, protecting ourselves from unfortunate decisions of a well-meaning administration. And I just want to mention, you know, at the Provost Forum, you and Ian wrote something which contained the following. The institutional autonomy of the university is the independence required to ensure that the demands societies place on university are not acceded to the point where only a ghost of academic freedom remains. And I can see writing that, you know, if one is not educated, but having had the education now, having gone to the conference and seeing what academic freedom really is, you know, I think that if Mott adopted this position and supported the provost's confounding of institutional autonomy and academic freedom, it would be a serious betrayal of its members and the faculty at McGill.
Thank you. So there are a number of points that were raised there that also I think we were thinking would come up. As you mentioned, for example, how contracts can influence things, and something we were hoping would come up under the section of private sector partnerships. And we're particularly interested in hearing, so there are general rhetoric, but it would also be useful to have sort of concrete concerns that people have that perhaps might fall between the cracks. There was another hand. Yes, Bob.
So my name is Bob Miles, and I'm on the MAUT Council. I guess my question might go more towards your introductory remarks, and I'm wondering where this is leading, that today we're going to deal with details, and I'm concerned about process. You mentioned in your introductory remarks that the committee would come up with recommendations and have them reviewed by the general membership. We had a motion last November on council that the principles of the CAUT, the six principles, would be followed, and that before any recommendations were made or participation with the university in a statement of on academic freedoms, the MAUT involvement would be ratified both first by council and then by general membership. And for me, preferably, that would be in a referendum. You said reviewed by the general membership. There are two sets of principles, and I'm just wondering if you're going to, before you get into the details, if the committee has put together a set of principles that mirror in some way the short six-point set of principles of CAUT, or the short six-point process of principles of the Association of University Colleges of Canada.
So thank you for that. That's not what this forum is here to address. I was pretty clear, I think, in the invitation, but it's a question we can certainly consider. If you'd like to pursue that question at some length, I suggest we do that at the very end of the presentation of the forum today. We can pursue that, but I think right now that's not really what's on the agenda.
It's just my personal view, but I think you're putting the horse before the cart.
Thank you. Anyone else that wants to speak on the general topic? So far, I haven't seen anything that sort of touches on this rubric, which is fine, but I just want to make sure that people who have something to say in this rubric get a chance to say something. Yes.
My name is Darren Barney. I'm not a member of MAUT, but thanks for lunch. And so you should take these remarks in that context. I'm just kind of confused and dismayed by your response to my colleague Jonathan Stern's question at the outset. After a presentation that's being given to us to frame the question of possible threats to academic freedom at McGill, a perfectly reasonable question is, how did MAUT respond to that litany of actual violations of freedom of expression? And we're told that that's not the issue that we're to be discussing.
That's right. That's not the issue. If you'd like to take that up as an issue, I wouldn't want to preempt any discussion. Let me just interrupt you for a second. We can do that at the end. I'd like to make sure that the agenda here gets met first. Right. If people still want to have further elaboration, I'm happy to stay here for the rest of the afternoon and address all of these questions. But I really would like to make sure we get through the agenda here and not get stuck on discussing process and things that happened in the past, which are important, which is why I invited Sharon to come here and make her presentation. Okay, so I would like to get on to the agenda. Unless you have something on this point, I actually prefer that we just put it off till later, if you don't mind.
Okay, but the point now is academic freedom and McGill. Is that correct?
That's right. We're interested in the sorts of things that are similar to what happened to the librarians that may have happened to other faculties, to find out what specific events people are concerned about, what kind of threat, for example, you might feel in your department or in your faculty that you think are potential threats to academic freedom, so we can have those things in the back of our minds as we start to frame something in general. But this other issue, I'm not saying it's not important. I'd be happy to discuss it with you. Be happy to do that. I would happy to do, have an audience here. I'd like to put that at the end, and we could come back to it at the end.
All right, so to specify, all you're looking for under this item is more stories of the nature of which
right, to heard. See the sorts of, so for just, maybe I'll give you a little bit more information. So what I found very interesting at the provost's conference and also at the conference that I went to in Toronto was I was suddenly made aware of things that I, as someone who's in the linguistics department, formerly in the philosophy department, was not aware of. For example, the way in which professional norms impinge upon academic freedom. So I want to make sure that if we're a committee here and we each come from our own particular backgrounds, we're exposed to as wide a set of experiences as possible. Some of us know the librarian situation quite well. I'm one of them. That's something that's very important. But I also like to know, are there problems, for example, in physical and occupational therapy? Are there problems in the faculty of medicine that we wouldn't even begin to think of? So this is the point of the forum, and I would appreciate having discussion on that topic. If it turns out that that's a five-minute topic, we can move on to these other things quite easily. I'd be happy to do so. Yes, please.
Yeah, Margot Somerville from Law and Medicine. I'd suggest that the first thing that we have to decide is what is the purpose of academic freedom. And I think it's only then that you can decide whether there are wrongful infringements of it. And a lot of academics seem to believe that academic freedom is to benefit them. I disagree with that. I think the primary purpose of academic freedom is to benefit the public so that we can have free discussions so that the public can be as informed as possible. After all, they're the ones that are basically paying for us. And I'd just like to give, some of you probably know, I'm not known as staying out of problems, let's put it that way. And I had an experience in relation to academic freedom here at McGill, but it went exactly the opposite way. Was when Bernard Shapiro was the principal, and he phoned me up one day and he said, Margot, I thought I should let you know, we've just had one of our major donors say, unless you fire that woman instantly, I will never give another cent to McGill. And it was because I'd been gone public on a topic that was very controversial. And there was a silence, and I said to him, well, what are you going to do? He said, oh, nothing. He said, that's your academic freedom. But he said, I just thought you should know. And so I actually gave him a huge amount of credit for actually letting me know. And also, with respect, I mean, that library list is a bit like a laundry list for a library. It's really shocking, but I happen to know the person you were talking about, and I suggest as well that we have to make a distinction between someone who's doing a very bad job and very bad things as the leader, and of course it's got impact on academic freedom, but why wasn't that dealt with more as an employment problem than anything else?
Mark had his hand up first, and then Edith, and then I think we're out with the 15 minutes for this session is over. If there's still further people, other people want to speak, we'll keep a list and we'll come back to it in the general discussion.
Just a very quick answer to Margaret's question, because I don't have time to get into a long one, but the problem was not just the actions of our director. The problem was that the actions of our director fit into a larger context. The higher administration of this university had made it quite clear to us that it wanted to abolish tenure and sabbatical leaves for librarians. This was part of a larger attack. And I believe that our director was hired precisely because her management style was exactly the kind of thing that the higher administration of the university was looking for.
Edith, did you want to...
I guess the topic that I just wanted to mention probably could come under a variety of subheadings that you've got here. But we had an issue that's actually still ongoing in the public media. And it had to do with the asbestos research that was done here at McGill. And we brought a motion to Senate, hoping that the university would make a statement about it. And it was really quite interesting because in the Senate debate, the people who were, I suppose, more knowledgeable about the details of the biomedical side of it kind of saw it from one perspective. And other individuals who I have a great deal of respect for saw it from a different perspective, whether or not what we were proposing would be an infringement on the academic freedom of a particular faculty member. And so here was a place where people from different disciplines saw it through a different set of lenses. And we could come back to this particular case perhaps later on if you think it would be appropriate. But here's a zone where I think... It's one thing what you publish and then what you say in public. And the problem here was that what the person was saying in public didn't quite correspond to what they had published. And so the position was, well, they can say whatever they want in public. But in public, this person was being recognized as a biomedical scientist at McGill, and so what he was saying in public was credited differently than if he'd been just anybody. So that's just an example of some of the things you have to think about when you think about what really is academic freedom.
Thank you. So I think we were allotting 15 minutes for this first topic. I suspect we probably went over time, which is fine. I thought we next move on to see if there are any contributions regarding academic freedom and funding agencies. And maybe I'll just add a few words to perhaps stir the pot or provide you with some information in case you're not aware of it. There's been a tendency over the last 15 or 20 years for the number of non-academics on the governing boards of the various agencies to be reduced and the number of non-academics to be increased. I gather currently, I think in NSERC, I think there are only two academic members. Please check me on that fact. That was hearsay that I heard, but it's certainly consistent with what I've seen, for example, on SHRC. There are relatively few academic members. So this is a concern, and a parallel concern with this is the bypassing of the granting agencies to donate, to give money, grants to institutions without going through the peer review process. So these are at least some of the issues that we're generally aware of, and be interested to hear from you and from anyone in the audience here if you have views about this particular, these alleged facts, and they should be checked, and also if you've had other things of a similar ilk that have occurred, we'd be very interested in hearing about that as well. So everyone is hunky-dory as far as the granting agencies are concerned. They're worrying along just how they ought to be worrying along, and there's no... Okay, this is even more time for the general discussion. So since that seems not to be a hot-button topic, let's move on to another topic here that was already just raised, namely the way in which, for example, donors can have adverse effects on academic freedom. So here the concern is, as you just heard from the example, is exactly that, where someone can try to impinge upon the internal operation of the academy by threatening to withdraw money or to contribute money and trying to buy chairs and things of that nature. This is a concern, to quote a case that we heard about recently at the conference we were in Toronto. It's not uncommon for private institutions, for example, the Koch Foundation, to give money to found particular programs within universities, and those programs will have a particular political slant to them, and they'll have power to affect who gets positions and who doesn't get positions and who is hired into positions. That's sort of a general problem. So again, that's another topic that we've heard about, and we would like to find out the is that something at McGill that we ought to be worried about? And if so, has anyone had any direct experience with this? We've had one example. Thank you very much for that example.
I would suggest that there's a rather narrow line here between, on the one hand, a donor interfering with academic freedom, but yet at the same time, this university and most other universities have been dependent upon major donors who, through giving money, have really determined academic priorities. You look at the history of this university, without major benefactors, women's education, engineering, science, medicine would not have been able to develop as they did. I think one wants to have nuance on this point. In other words, you would like to encourage donors, and you accept the fact that they are probably, through their benefactions, going to determine some academic priorities. The major gifts that were given, for instance, Days Hotel for management, Schulich for music, how can this not have an academic impact? I guess the nuance is, are they carrying it one step further and attempting, therefore, to determine how things will be, what will be taught, how it's within a faculty or department, and in some way limit academic freedom. But I think the nuance would be that one would not want to discourage donors because without them, frankly, many of the academic activities at this university that we take for granted would be impossible.
Thank you.
If I can just go back for a second to the previous one, which is related.
Could you identify yourself?
I'm Andrei Kostopoulos. I am from the anthropology department. If I can just go back to the previous one for a minute, because I think the two are related.
Sure, please do.
I think the problem in terms of is not at the level of the granting agencies. Problems have been faced in terms of academic freedom, in terms of freedom of inquiry, because they're not academics, but by scientists and researchers directly employed by the federal government or the provincial government. That's where there's been significant interference. And I think academic freedom has actually been important in bringing this forward as a problem. If you look at, for example, Andy Bush at UBC, has a lot of former students and friends and colleagues who work for the federal government as environmental scientists, then he's been able to, because of his protected position, he's been able to point out the extent of the interference that has gone on in certain federal and provincial agencies in Canada in terms of the nature of environmental research that goes on and the censoring, I think you can say, of results, in terms of control of the release of results about environmental change and their impact on policy. So academic freedom in that respect has actually been a very important resource and continues to be. In terms of the granting agencies, they set research priorities. They have their priorities, and if they choose to fund some research or choose not to fund other research, that's not an infringement on academic freedom. You can continue to do the research. You may not get money for it, but it's not a question of academic freedom. You know, but in this case, academic freedom has been quite important, I would say.
Thank you for bringing that to our attention, Jonathan. I'll just interrupt for 1 second. So it looks like we're not getting the rush to the microphones that we prepared for. So I think I will relax a bit, the rules. I had the rules in place because I thought, gee, there might be like lines of people at the microphone. So we'll still keep the general schedule. We'll come back to things, but it seems like things are fairly relaxed. So please, if you want to go back to something, yes. If it turns out we're getting long lines, then I'll impose some kind of discipline. So Jonathan, please.
Well, now I'm really waiting for number 7 because the things I want to talk about don't fall under these. But to Andre's point, there is an issue here which goes exactly against the assertion of institutional autonomy, which is institutional interdependence. Modern universities depend a lot on funding from external agencies other than the state. There have been times where the state has been the primary source with some private donors who sort of give money and say, you know, with blessings. More and more, that's not the case. And the result of it has not been so much a direct infringement on freedom of inquiry, but something much more subtle and insidious, which is that the institution's constant thirst for money, right or wrong, I'm not saying McGill isn't underfunded, the institution's constant thirst for money becomes more and more something that crosses the horizon of professors' attention. So more and more professors have it made their concern that the university does not have enough money and are then asked to, say, participate in fundraising, participate in grant getting above and beyond the basic amount of money that they need to do their research. And this is all because the institution has needs that it's trying to figure out how to deal with. I don't have a brilliant answer or solution for this, but I think to say, okay, we're talking about direct threats to academic freedom, one of the big issues is you're looking at funding agencies and donors. Sure, I can point to cases where I believe donors were given much too much entitlement with respect to the money that they gave to the university so they could start saying, well, this lecture should be about this, and hey, I'd like to come be a visiting fellow in the center I helped endow, and things like that that I think are completely corrupt. But that's not the big issue. That's, like, annoying. The big issue is this much more, like I said, subtle and insidiousness, sort of curvature of the institution's priorities, and because it bears so much weight down, when it gets down to the faculty, like, I think upper admin, part of their job is to protect us from this. Instead, what's happened is more and more it's been made our problem.
Thank you. Anyone else that wants to address anything on this topic? And remember, we can always come back into the general discussion. Oh, yes. Sorry, John.
So I just wanted to build on Andre's point, but to push it in a slightly different direction. It seems to me that we're talking about a sliding scale between the provision of money for free research, which I think all academics favor and cherish, and the complete government determination of the priorities of research and where targeted monies are going to go. Obviously, this, in the extreme, does infringe on academic freedom because it basically says there's certain work that cannot be done. I think we're always going to be dealing with a sliding scale and some sort of balance between these two extremes. But as we see, the slide towards more and more targeted research, more and more, in effect, political decisions about what academic research should do, I think we should be alert. And of course, this lies in the political domain, and it's up to academics and their and administrators, university leaders, to make their views known. I'm not saying this is the most insidious if it's some sort of balance, but we see some agencies pushing a little bit too much or being pushed by the government through their ruling boards, their governing boards, towards targeted and strategic research. Or even direct donations, direct grants to certain academic bodies to do certain things. Then it becomes almost like a set of contractual research, and I think we have to be very alert about this problem.
Thank you, John. Anything else? Yes, please.
To ask Jonathan, I think I'm a director of a foundation that funds your department very heavily, and I'm a little alarmed that you think we're corrupt. And and it is true that the former president of the foundation, and there's only three of us that make these decisions as to where the money goes, has, I think, visited and had sort of engagement with your department, and we're careful about it, partly because I'm on the board and I don't want to get into trouble. But I think you've got to be realistic as well, that if you're giving very large amounts of money, here we're talking something in the region of $5 million that's been given, those people want some reward, some public recognition for that. And when you're sitting on the board and you're trying to convince them that McGill's the place that ought to go, you do have to say, you know, that you can in some way feel that you're involved in this. You can some way feel that you've helped to do this. And so I think you've got to be very, very careful. I agree that we've got to have rules that make it clear that there's not what we'd call in law undue influence. But at the same time, I think we're all human, and we have to recognize that the people making those decisions are very human too, and they want some sort of feeling of connection with it.
Thank you. I think we have a response.
All right. So first of all, I want to point – sorry, I keep doing that. You assumed I was talking about your organization. We can get into the – do you really want to get into the details of the Beaverbrook Foundation's funding of Media McGill? I mean, we can talk about that, but that's not what I was trying to – that's not the issue I was trying to raise here. So – yeah, I mean, I feel like I'm being asked to explain myself for things that would involve getting into much greater detail than perhaps you'd want to get into here. But I don't believe that's a fair characterization of what I just said. So I'll leave it at that.
Well, I appreciate the – because we like to keep this at a general level, so I appreciate the exchange, and I appreciate your making that decision. Bernard, did you want to say something? Thank you.
Yeah, I'd like to extend a little bit on John's point and what was made previously. The agencies are changing their funding formula, and they are encouraging much more directed research. And I think that's a direct consequence of government applying pressure on those agencies. There's a need for the government to demonstrate that what they invest in research pays off before the next election. That's not new. That's happened for many, many years. And we've seen creation of agencies in order to allow a government to be able to associate itself with what they have created. I think it behooves us to maintain academic freedom to push the agencies towards maintaining as large a section to open research as possible, but to take advantage of the other system as well. We don't want to give up on applied research or directed research simply because somebody says, if you work in this area, you know, you'll have more money. Let's take advantage of it. Maximizing basic research is critical. Investigator-initiated research is critical. And allowing the researcher to do what they want is critical. So that really is to the point that John raised. The other point you were asking about impinging on academic freedom, there is there had been, I think it's less today, but a tradition in clinical departments of having unit heads, who in hospitals are called chiefs and not chairs, to direct the research of what is going on in their department. I think we're very fortunate that trend is decreasing, not increasing. And I think there's been more instances of curtailing of academic freedom in small clinical units where PhDs had to work on the basic theme of a clinical head. I think we are not at MAUT sensitive enough to what's happening within the workings of our research institutes and our hospitals, and the degree to which their academic freedom is limited. And again, I speak from experience because, in fact, I was in that situation where I was told I could not work in a certain field, or because I worked in a certain field, I had to leave. And it is the VP academic who, in fact, told the chief that he could not do that. So academic freedom worked very well in terms of the university administration supporting my academic freedom, but there are steps along the way that where it can be blocked. And I think we need to be very sensitive to those issues in hospital context.
Thank you. So I for one, find these details in these difficult cases very helpful in trying to think about the problem in general. So if there anyone else want to make a contribution to this segment?
please.
Peter McNally again. There's also, of course, the very, very opposite case when you talk about academic freedom and funding. And this is people who are doing research and work in fields which requires little or nothing in the way of money, but yet they feel that they are under enormous pressure to submit research grants and to get research money, even though, frankly, it's not particularly relevant or necessary, and they're told that unless they do get research money, that they are not going to get tenure or promotion, and there will be a negative impact upon their merit increases. And I've certainly encountered cases of this myself. I've even had it suggested to me upon occasion. I won't say that this how wide I can't say that it's necessarily widespread, but I think this is the other side of it all. Why must one have funding if one doesn't need funding and is still very, very productive? And being told that it's not enough to publish and even to publish well, if you don't bring in research grants, you're not actually doing research.
Thank you. Edith.
Actually, I'd just like to respond to what Professor McNally said. I think he made a very valuable point. And I have also seen that happen as an MAUT advisor. I've seen someone who could write her books without external funding and was criticized for not receiving external funding. And then looking back through her career, there were years where it was very difficult to get SHRC funding and so on, and this person was quite creative and got some funding from some private sources and then was criticized, saying this wasn't peer-reviewed, so it really didn't count, and you don't have SHRC funding, so you're being devalued. So I think he brought up a very valid point that we really often don't think about.
If I could just intervene, it seems to me that it comes back to the point that Jonathan was making about the fundraising aspects and the pressure comes down, and of course we had to get money, and so you automatically build this into requirements in for merit and tenure and so forth. I think that's certainly a very useful point. Anything else on this topic? John.
I don't want to intervene too much, but I just wanted to reflect on the other side of the coin. The encouragement and the political pressure to increase research funds that are available is, at the end of the day, really serving to enlarge our possibilities of doing various types of research. Now, obviously, if you don't need the funding, fine. But some administrative encouragement to apply for people who are quite able to apply and to get funds for graduate students, for instance, it seems to me is quite legitimate. There are various ways we fund graduate students, and one of them is through research grants, and that's sort of built into the system, and it's a system that the universities have encouraged, and they exercise pressure to enlarge that amount of money that's available. At the end of the day, research funds available increase our academic freedom to pursue free research in various areas. So admittedly, the abuses, taking money where you don't need it, there's no justification, but let's keep in mind the big picture. That if we can bring in funds that then can be used to support students and other activities, that's not a bad thing.
Thank you. So we started 10 minutes late, and we're surprisingly on schedule. I guess given that we started 10 minutes late, we are 10 minutes behind schedule, so in that sense on time. So maybe we'll move to the – it was a bit convoluted, sorry. We'll move it now to the topic of, again, something that I was completely insensitive to until I heard the presentation at the Provost's Conference on academic freedom, namely the impact of professional accreditation bodies on academic freedom. In other words, the worry about the extent to which accreditation bodies can dictate the internal content of courses and things of that nature. And again, it's something that we wanted to hear something more about. If people have experience with this or have views on it, we really welcome hearing about that. So if anyone has anything to say, be happy to hear from you about that. This doesn't look like it's a gripping topic for this audience.
Peter McNally. I came to listen, but I end up talking, but it's in my character. I am a member on the faculty of the School of Information Studies, which has been continuously accredited by the American Library Association since 1927, and it considers it very important. 30 years ago, around 1980, we had an extremely difficult situation in our school, and there certainly were infringements of academic freedom. Fortunately, the American Library Association, in its accreditation in 1980, intervened, and it pointed out that there was a very, very serious problem here, and it gave the school conditional accreditation, which forced the university to take action. So I would say, in this case, professional accreditation proved to be extremely helpful in preserving academic freedom, because it took an outside body to come in and to point out that there was a problem which the university must address, and which the university hitherto, although it was very aware that there was a problem, had been unwilling to address and to take action on.
Thank you. It's actually nice to hear kind of a balancing comment. So rather than always casting the accreditation or whatever as a negative role, people can play a very positive role, and that's really nice to hear. Anything else that anyone wants to say? Again, we can always come back to this, but since I don't see anyone jumping up to go to the microphone, and it'll probably be best when we get to the general discussion, then people can say, feel more or less constrained. I'll move on now to the next one. So we've talked about this already, namely private sector partnerships for the private sector and worries about that, and we've seen already some pros and cons. I think we all understand. I think this was addressed a little bit in this brief article that Ian and I did together, that there's, you know, clearly to the extent that we receive things from the outside, there's a kind of a quid pro quo relationship. We want to make sure that quid pro quo relationship doesn't compromise the basic character of the university. And then the question is, how do you work that out of the details? So again, I'd be curious to hear whether or not anyone here has had experience that's analogous to experiences we've heard about elsewhere. One of the cases that was elaborated on, again, I don't know the details except from what I heard from secondhand, was the case of Novartis at the University of California, Berkeley, setting up a partnership with the University of California, Berkeley Plant Science Biology Plant Biology Department, and some of the risks and problems that came with that. I don't know if there's been anything comparable here to McGill, or people are concerned about that kind of a problem where the outside partner can overstep what we would consider to be the proper bounds of partnership with the university. Yes, please.
Yeah, I've had experience with that, and in fact, it involved Novartis. very briefly, what happened was Europe banned clinical trials of xenotransplantation. That's taking an organ from, in this case, pigs and putting it into humans. And the reason was that there was a remote possibility that we could wipe out the human race by doing that with a new virus. And there were also lesser possibilities for other people to get infected. Anyway, by accident, I found out from a reporter that these pigs, which had been at Cambridge University in England, had been secretly flown into Mirabel and then had been taken to the Guelph University. And just prior to that, the government had asked me to chair a conference in Ottawa on what would be the ethics of doing xenotransplantation in clinical trials. And at the time I said to them, but you're not going to do this, are you? And they said, oh, no, we just want to know what would be the rules if we did do it. So then what I did when I found this out is I phoned the University of Guelph and I talked to the researcher who was involved. But he said, look, I can't talk to you now. I have to get back to you. And the next thing that happened was I was phoned by the communications director at Novartis, who said to me, we're not prepared to make a statement about this, and our researchers at the University of Guelph have been told not to speak to you because they've signed confidentiality agreements. So I then wrote a chapter for a book I published and it was published by Penguin, so they sent it to their lawyers to make sure they weren't going to get sued for defamation, because I wrote a chapter on this, and quite a bit of what was in that chapter, they wanted it taken out because they were scared we would be sued for defamation, but it, nevertheless, the chapter went ahead and it was basically okay. But so, I mean, that's just one example that I personally got involved in, so I don't know whether there's other things like that, but I would suspect that I would be very surprised if I was the only example where that sort of thing had happened.
No, I would be surprised as well. I understand, and I don't know if anyone's had experience with this, that in fact sometimes universities sign secret agreements with various companies regarding the research that they're doing.
Yes, that's true, and what I think you need to do, and I've done this, is that when you sign a contract, you ask them to modify that confidentiality clause. I don't think it's ethical to sign that. I mean, that's what happened with Nancy Oliveri.
Okay. Thank you. Bruce?
I guess I didn't introduce myself last time. Bruce Reed from Computer Science. Well, you mentioned the Novartis case from Stanford that we heard about last weekend in Toronto. I just wanted to point out that much of that presentation was about a critic of that that relationship who was denied tenure by the chancellor despite a unanimous decision, 17-1 in favor from the external reviewers, and in fact originally all the reviewers were unanimously in favor, but the chancellor asked for more reviewers. Unanimous decision by the department, unanimous decision, I think, by the faculty and the university tenure committees, and then the chancellor, not happy with this critic of the deal, denied him tenure, and it was only when that chancellor left and a new chancellor came in that that decision was overturned. So again, I'd like to suggest that this focus on the external rather than the focus on the internal, even in this particular case that you've mentioned, is perhaps inappropriate.
Thank you. Yes, and there was some Canadian content to that, I believe. The chancellor that went to Berkeley came from the University of Toronto to save the day.
Yeah, I mean, the focus on the internal, I think, is important. We're one step beyond, right now, the relationship with the private partners. My own concern revolves around something called spin-offs from the university. So the university right now, you know, is spawning, essentially, private enterprises that arise from the research of faculty members and that become private partners in which the university has a stake financially and in which the faculty member has a stake financially. And there you set up a situation in which not only you've got Bruce's cookie jar to worry about, but you also have very intense pressure for research to go a certain way, for research results to be communicated or not, depending on how they influence the prospects of the spin-off business. And this pressure applies equally to the faculty member and to the university itself as an institution. So it's one step beyond just having a private partner, and the pressures are that much stronger. And that is where I can see a real threat to academic freedom developing if this model becomes more general across the university.
Thank you. And this is something I only learned of recently and know very little about, but certainly prima facie, it strikes me as very worrisome. Need to learn more about that. Anything else on this particular topic? John, do you have something to say?
I actually have nothing substantive to say, but let me just...
Well, let's haul him off the stage.
But it raises for me the larger question of what should be the role of confidentiality in university contracting and research. I know there's the possibility of taking a doctoral dissertation and putting it aside and not releasing it to the public for a certain length of time so that the publications can occur. Okay, that seems to be an issue of balance. There are, I believe, up to 2 years or something of that sort. But if there are confidentiality restrictions built in, which are indefinite, it seems to me that begins to transgress the whole notion of free research and communication results. So maybe this needs some more further discussion and analysis with regard to university policy.
So we've come to the end of the list of topics that we wanted to make sure we heard about. And we can always come back to any of these, but now the floor is open for a much broader discussion. I assume that everyone who wanted to speak has already spoken on these topics. So I'll open up the floor for more general discussion, but we're particularly interested in hearing about cases without getting into too many specifics, because we don't want to, if it turns out that there are parties who've been on opposite sides of a particular issue, we don't want to get into the details, but we do want to know about the principles. So please, and please identify yourself.
Hi, I'm Robert Zatori from the Montreal Neurological Institute. I just wanted to raise an issue which may be relevant to anyone that's doing research with human participants, which includes everything from clinical trials to someone doing surveys or anything of the like. And that is that, of course, we're required to go through a research ethics board to get approval for the procedures and so on, and confidentiality and all of that sort of thing, which is essential. But I had the particular experience where our research ethics board said to me that although they found the research to be perfectly ethical, there was no problem with any of the procedures or the ways in which we were going to ensure confidentiality and so on, that they found the research to be uninteresting and of no particular importance, and therefore they turned it down. And it seems to me that and I had no particular recourse, because there is no statement of academic freedom that I could refer to, and so I was sort of left high and dry. The kicker to this story is, turned out well, which is that after a lot of additional argumentation, presenting a lot of evidence, et cetera, they eventually allowed us to do the research, and the paper's coming out in Science.
Thank you. I'd like to hear stories of the happy ending. Yes.
Oh, I have a different duck. I'm not going to respond to his comment.
No, that's okay. The floor is now, okay. Your name, please.
I'm Nicole Couture. I'm from the Department of Anthropology, and I'm an archaeologist who works in Highland, Bolivia. So last Friday, I went to the skill set session on academic integrity. So it's actually an interesting counterpart to today. And I was intrigued by the fact that the main topics in the skill set session were about intellectual rights, intellectual property, and competition, particularly between graduate students and different researchers. And I think that's part of today's discussion. What I want to do is actually change the topic, in a sense, or the agenda, into which sort of leaving aside the question of rights and obligations to us, but rather to those that we have to others. So what are our obligations and responsibilities to other kinds of stakeholders and communities? And I think other speakers today have touched on this. So, and in my case, I want to talk about the different kinds of communities and stakeholders that I work with who aren't included in any of the categories raised today. So working in Bolivia on a major monumental site, I need to get a research permit from the Vice Ministry of Culture, and then I have to get it approved by about 7 to 10 other kinds of government bodies that range from the Institute of Archaeology to the local mayor's office to the leaders of indigenous communities. So even if I have a 5-year permit, any one of those 10 stakeholders can stop it. And they can impose different kinds of restrictions or conditions on the research that I carry out. And some of them are actually according to international law. So anything I excavate, of course, remains in Bolivia. That's an international treaty. Bolivia is also one of the poorest countries in the Americas. I think it's second only to Haiti in terms of poverty. So we're now being asked to provide infrastructure, to build labs, to build storage facilities, equipment, etc. So, but what is happening now is these different groups asking for control over what we would consider intellectual property. So there's a movement now to change the law so that I can't publish anything, even a photograph, unless I have permission from the Bolivian government. Different groups are now asking for, in a sense, the right to compose my research agenda. So there's a conflict in the sense of how do I get permission, from SHRC, say, you know, if I say, hey, this is my research question and this is how it's informed, but in fact the local community wants me to excavate this big pyramid because it would be great for tourism. And now more recently, there's this conflict because we're being asked to build labs, but then they have the right locally to take away our lab and give it to someone else because it suits their agenda. So part of this I agree with. I think there are historical reasons behind these demands, but it's now placing lots of constraints pragmatically in terms of what we can and cannot do that are difficult to fulfill. But I think there are some broader questions that are being asked in terms of how do we include different kinds of voices in establishing our research agendas that we don't normally include or acknowledge within the academy. The best we might do is have a line in our acknowledgements. It's like, well, thank you to my token Indigenous people for helping my research. So I think these are issues that need to be included in this discussion of academic freedom. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Jonathan.
I've been waiting to go with, which is 2 points. One is academic freedom exists insofar as there are people willing to fight for and defend it. Without that, it doesn't matter what statement of principles you adopt. It doesn't matter through what process you adopt it. If there are not people fighting for it, advocating it, and committed to it, it doesn't happen. It doesn't exist. As you know, Margot's story amply illustrates, right? The principal took a hit in order to defend academic freedom. And that's the most important thing. And that was why I asked the question I asked after the library story, because my concern, we're going to disagree about some of the principles that ought to go into a statement on academic freedom at McGill, and I can live with that. What I will have a harder time living with is organizations who are charged with defending the values of the faculty, whether we're talking about MAUT or the Senate, failing to do that. That, to me, is a much greater concern. And so that's the first point. Second point is, on this institutional autonomy, I'm just curious. Academic freedom as a concept has existed for about a century, at least. It might go back further. But the stories I read all start with the AAUP. And the Declaration of Principles around academic freedom and tenure. So what I'm curious is, as far as I know, institutional autonomy is something that Tony Massey made up as a concept. Is it present in the academic freedom literature? I mean, there's the whole three-legged stool, which is academic freedom, tenure, and faculty governance, right? And McGill, at McGill, our stool's already a little wobbly if you look at where the Senate is on the org chart. But I'm just wondering because I've read some. I'm sure if there were actual academic freedom scholars in the room, they would have read much more than me. But I don't see a lot. And institutional autonomy seems to me like a necessary condition, but so do a lot of other things. Like to do our jobs, the rooms also have to have heat. But we wouldn't put a statement on heating into an academic freedom policy. So I'll just leave it at that.
Sure. Bernard?
Just to clarify a couple of points. Quebec wrote a policy on academic freedom in the 90s, and there was a committee that did research on that theme for about 2 years. Academic freedom comes from la tenure, which relates to tenure, which is back to the Middle Ages, which is a priest's right to express an opinion against the church without fear of reprisal. So, and it has nothing to do with an academic institution. So the origin of academic freedom is expressing an opinion in an area where you have expertise without fear of reprisal. That's what it's about. And to me, we have to keep those two things separate. Institutional autonomy is an important concept and should be defended on its own. Academic freedom is a different concept and has to be defended on its own.
Thank you. I guess Bob had his hand up first, then I saw Dan next, and I saw Mark.
As to the two, Jonathan and the other question, academic autonomy or institutional autonomy certainly isn't something that Tony Massey has made up. However, it is something that he has elaborated upon. The the first principal of the Association of University Colleges, Association of Universities and Colleges of Canada, of the short six-point list, reads the first principle, the AUCC believes that the principles of academic freedom and institutional autonomy are essential to the fulfillment of the role of universities in the context of a democratic society. This, in fact, conflates to the question the issue of academic freedom and institutional autonomy. Point six of the CAUT statement, which was written in response to the AUCC statement, reads, point six, academic freedom must not be confused with institutional autonomy. Tony Massey, in a statement last fall, from his discussion document on academic, actually it's December 2011, his discussion document on academic freedom, like the AUCC document, his number one item is institutional autonomy. And he says, quote, in order to guarantee that scholarly activity in the pursuit of knowledge and service to society can be properly conducted, universities must have autonomy from unwarranted incursion by outside authorities and be protected from allegiance to unquestioning orthodoxies. So that's just a point of information.
Thank you. Let me see. I think the order next was Dan. If I could just say one thing before you start. I was just going to say that I was formerly a philosopher, and the APA, the American Philosophical Association, would have a symposium. Someone would write a book, and there would be a symposium on that. And this is not a symposium on Tony Massey's paper, though I perfectly agree with your comment, and I think we all agree with it, but it's not going to be a symposium on Tony Massey. This is here for us to decide. For us to get information about what we think academic freedom is. Dan, please.
There's just an interesting point by Ronald Dworkin on the distinction between academic freedom and freedom of speech that I think relates to this issue of institutional autonomy. Dworkin makes the point that academic freedom is larger than freedom of speech because freedom of speech actually doesn't protect you within institutional settings. It's freedom of speech within the public sphere. So if you're operating within a corporation or a government bureaucracy or a church, for example, your freedom of speech is actually severely constrained within that institutional setting. If you abuse that freedom of speech within the institutional setting, you can be fired, disciplined, censured, etc. Academic freedom precisely does that work of protecting faculty members, educators, within the internal frame of the institutional setting. So that's the unique work it actually does in terms of, and so it really has to be distinguished from institutional autonomy, which is protection from external pressures.
Thank you. Mark, John, and then Bruce. Right, John?
This is to try to give a fairly short answer to the question that was given, where was MAUT? I'm not quite sure who asked it. Where was MAUT when the librarians were going through this through these difficulties? I'm answering this from the point of view of a librarian. I'm one of the people who was on the receiving end of this abuse. I'm also a former chair of the librarian section. What I will give you is one of the possible answers. If you were to ask me this question, and I will try to keep it nuanced, because if you were to ask me this question in private, you might get a much less nuanced answer. And conversely, if you were to ask this question to the MAUT executive, you might get a different answer as well. But anyway, I think a nuanced way of presenting the answer is the following. When we came under attack, we tried to resolve these matters in different ways. We tried to use the internal grievance mechanisms of the university, and they proved to be ineffectual. I was one of the persons who had personal experience of how ineffectual these things are, and I'm an MAUT advisor. And I must say, from that respect, the MAUT advisors who participated in these cases gave sterling service. They were tremendously helpful and supportive, and I have nothing but praise in that respect. With regard to the larger issues, however, I know that the MAUT executive engaged the administration on this topic, on these topics, several times. We were essentially facing a collective harassment situation. These talks between the MAT executive and the administration proved ineffectual for at least one reason, possibly two reasons. The definite reason was the administration was not convinced or did not want to admit that there was any problem. The administration said there is no problem, there's nothing to solve here. The degree to which the MAUT executive as a whole or individually or within subsets, the degree to which the MAT executive was convinced that there was a problem is an issue I'm not going to go into. There was probably a range of answers on that. What eventually happened is the MAT librarian section, after many years, determined that the method that was being pursued by MAUT, which was to try to quietly resolve this behind the scenes, was not working. And what eventually happened is the MAT librarian section went to CAUT. CAUT set up a commission of inquiry, which investigated for an entire year, produced a report, which is confidential, gave the report to the administration, and said, here's a report, here are our findings, are you going to solve these problems, or do we publish the report? The administration went through the standard three-step checklist. Perhaps they get it from AUCC, because apparently every university that gets such a report from CAUT goes through a three-step checklist. The first checklist is they say that it's a pack of lies. The second item on the checklist is they threaten to sue CAUT. The third item on the checklist is when the university realizes that CAUT is when published the report and that CAUT can back up what's in the report, that's when the university administration starts talking, which they did. And eventually we were able to resolve these problems. So that's admittedly a very personal answer to the question that was asked.
John and then Bruce.
Actually, I have comments that go back to the last topic, so let me defer while people discuss the library issue if there are further points on that.
No, go ahead, John.
Well, I just wanted to come to the issue of institutional autonomy, which has become sort of a lightning rod for discussion of what do we not want to happen with respect to an assertion of institutional autonomy. What we don't want is a set of administrators saying, because we have institutional autonomy, we can act in a relatively arbitrary way vis-a-vis our faculty members or our university population as a whole. We don't want that. There are protections that have to be reinforced within the institution. Does that mean that there is no institutional autonomy? I think institutional autonomy is simply an aspect of the statutory nature of the university and many other institutions. And it's important, I think, not to give the administration carte blanche, but as a predicate for the assertion of academic freedom for members within. If we have let's say there's a scholar who gets a PhD, has a certain expertise, has the right to pursue that work, and of course freedom of speech means they can publish or talk about it, that person isn't protected by academic freedom. The reason we can assert our academic freedom is that we're within an academic institution. So it seems to me that the institutional autonomy is something that is the basis for academic freedom within that institution. Now, where do we want that actually to be effective? Well, we want the university to protect us, for instance, against confidentiality rules. And when it comes up, it shouldn't just be the researcher who says, no, that's not what we want to be included. We want the university, the research office, to say, no, that's not acceptable. We want to have some limits where it's appropriate on accreditation bodies, saying here are all the details that this particular unit must fulfill. Of course, you don't want to throw that out altogether. That's important if you want to be a social worker or a nurse, et cetera. But you want to have the faculty that are there have the right to have an effect and to basically modify the curriculum in their own lights. So there are a whole series of ways that the institution is vulnerable, and by asserting its institutional autonomy, it can protect us. But what we don't want it to do, and I think it has to be spelled out, in any statement or any principles we want to come up with is for any administration to see that as giving them the liberty to transgress academic freedom within the institution. I think that's a line that shouldn't be crossed over.
Thank you, John. So Bruce and Jeremy, and then Bob.
Hi, I have a comment and a question. One of my favorite pieces of music is Samba Duma No So. So sorry to be a one-note samba, but I'll continue with the same note. As Bernard mentioned, la tenure, the idea of academic freedom, comes from the right of the priest to criticize the church. That sounds pretty internal to me, right? And my question is, you know, you've kept saying that what you want is examples of all of these external people violating academic freedom. You don't want to discuss whether or not the paper that you've written confuses institutional autonomy and academic freedom. You don't want to get into that discussion. And my question to you is, why not? It would seem to me fundamental that if you're going to write something about academic freedom and instead you're writing something about institutional autonomy, that's a serious problem that you would want to address with your members. Instead, by not doing so, it seems to me you're continuing on the tradition of what Mark has described, where Mark does not defend academic freedom and it leaves it to other actors to do so, and I think it's time that stopped.
Sorry, is that a question addressed to me?
Why don't we want to discuss the institutional autonomy? You repeatedly said, that's not what I want to discuss here, I want examples of these things, I don't want to get into general principles. The question is, why don't we discuss whether or not the approach that's being taken confounds institutional autonomy and academic freedom inappropriately, and if our document should actually really address academic freedom.
Sorry, maybe I didn't make myself clear enough. I'll try again. The idea was that we had a certain agenda that we wanted to get through, and we've gotten through that agenda, and I said that there are other things that people wish to discuss, and there was time at the end. I'm more than happy to do that. We've come back to the librarian issue. I have no objection now that we've gotten through the agenda. If you would like to raise that for discussion, I have absolutely no objection. I just wanted to make sure that we got through the agenda we set up.
Well, I believe you just answered that to Jonathan during this part of the discussion. I can't remember the exact details, but I'm pretty sure.
Well, if I did, I misspoke, and I beg your pardon. I'm not putting any constraints on the discussion as of this point.
So how do you feel about the possible confusion between institutional and academic freedom, and how do you view those two matters and how they relate?
I think, in fact, my view was pretty much summed up by other people. They are distinct but related concepts. I think John actually said probably something that's pretty close to my own view. These are distinct things. And so far as... So I guess I can give you a longer discussion. I don't know, when you referred to a paper, referring to my paper that I wrote?
Let me read you again what you write in your paper and see if you agree with it.
Then. Okay.
The institutional autonomy of the university is the independence required to ensure that the demands society places in the university are not acceded to the point where only a ghost of academic freedom remains.
Right,
so you seem to suggest there that it's the institutional autonomy which will protect our academic freedom.
No, quite the contrary. If you read the entire article, the article starts out, in fact, I think you did because I was at the presentation.
The
idea, I mean, we can make this a symposium on my paper, which I'm happy to do, and so I'll address that. Maybe you should give me a limit of 5 minutes.
I'm not too worried about what you're... What's in your paper? What I'm concerned about is if the same thing comes out in the academic
right, freedom. Right. So I think what I wrote is completely consistent with the view expressed both by Bernard and by John, namely that there. I think first the question was actually originally raised by Ian. I thought it was a good question. We don't, just because we say we have a PhD, we don't have academic freedom. We have academic freedom insofar as we're some kind of a privileged group, and that's the way I put it, a community of scholars. And then that community of scholars puts together, is housed in an institution. And so there is institutional freedom is there in the service of academic freedom. And I think that's something we say in our paper. If I didn't, I'm sorry I didn't, but that's what I believe. If you want to talk about institutional autonomy, it only holds to the extent that it's going to protect academic freedom. So that's my view. We can discuss that, but that's my view.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
So Jeremy Cooperstock from engineering. I'd follow up on Bruce's comments and saying I think this is a discussion we need to have. I think it's a question that pervades all of the discussions that have taken place when we went through the agenda. There certainly were issues that came up under the context of institutional autonomy, but by far it seems the pressing issues are ones that are intramural, that is where academics are under threat from within, not from external sources. And when we see, as we've witnessed the exchange of emails and discussion regarding the symposium or the event that MAUT hosted sometime back, I guess in the fall, where CAUT, who had formulated...
No, that was not... The MAUT did not organize it. It was organized by the provost.
Okay, so MAUT was involved in that event.
We were invited to participate.
Okay, and CAUT was for some reason excluded. And I don't recall seeing a protest from the MAUT executive at the exclusion of CAUT, who represents, as far as I could see, the interests of academics in terms of protecting our academic freedom issues. Now, Benjamin Ginsberg at Johns Hopkins University wrote an interesting book last year called The Fall of the Faculty. And in that text, he describes the rise of what he calls the all-administrative university, in which funding dollars and number of staff and priorities in institutions have been steadily increasing in the ranks of the upper administration, while at the same time the number of faculty and the budget allocated to them, and in turn the freedoms enjoyed by the faculty members, has been steadily dwindling over the last number of years. And in that context that we see quite clearly at McGill as a prime example of that trend, I think it's clear to us that the institution as a whole does not require the protection, does not require us to be there bolstering the walls of McGill from these insidious outside forces. The institution, in terms of its administration, certainly has the wherewithal and the means to fight for institutional independence and institutional autonomy. The question is, for us as an MAUT member, or as MAUT members here, what MAUT is doing for us in terms of protecting our academic freedom. And in that sense, I'm concerned or deeply troubled by the lack of protest at CUT's exclusion from the event in the fall. Whether or not MAUT played a role in organizing it, I would think that as a party to that event and as a body that is ultimately representing us as faculty members, it was incumbent upon MAUT to ensure participation by CAUT, who had fought so hard to champion those principles that we hold dear. So I think the points that Bruce is bringing up warrant discussion because of that very question, and it's
What precisely do you want discussed? Would you like the question of why MAUT didn't insist on CAUT's participation, or do you want to answer the question, what is MAUT doing to protect academic freedom, or both questions?
It's a multifaceted discussion that touches those two questions, but also the general role of MAUT, for example, was brought up earlier. Where was MAUT, what was MAUT doing to protect the librarians back in the litany of stories that we heard from before?
There are three questions.
Well, I think it goes beyond those three, but I think
What's the fourth question?
It's a general discussion that I think we need to have, and so far we've had...
Great. Where would you like us to start?
Well, we can start with the first one. Why was MAUT not protesting the exclusion of CAUT?
This was a decision taken by MAUT, but I had a view on this. I'll tell you what my own view is. Maybe it's wrong. It was something initiated by the provost, and I regarded this in the same way as a colleague of mine initiated, let's say, some kind of a conference on some subject. It didn't bother to consult me or invite me. I would certainly be offended. I wouldn't particularly like it. But, you know, they have certainly a perfect right to go ahead and do that. So by analogy, in fact, the provost did consult. In fact, a better person to talk to was there from the beginning, I understand, it was Jonathan Stern, just behind you at the table. So you could get more detail, probably reliable detail from him as to what was going on the other side. But our own view was, my view was that if the administration wanted to organize something, that was fine. That was their business. We can always organize what we want to organize. I didn't think it was, an issue. And we have organized something. We have a different view. We're undertaking our own process here. It just seems to me they have every right in the world to do it on their own. So that's my answer to your first question. I know that, Bob, you want me to answer his questions? You want to come up and
I want to comment on that particular question.
Okay.
First of all, members of MAUT Council did protest very vigorously and in emails and in telephone conversations with the Deputy Provo, I did, and supported by three other council members, but not the executive, that CAUT was not invited. But I want to get, if I can, go back to a comment, I think a misunderstanding that institutional autonomy is necessarily a bogeyman. I'm not suggesting that. In fact, it is part of the CAUT six principles, the difference being that the CAUT principle, and I think you might all like to hear the definition of institutional autonomy according to CAUT, since it was accepted as a principle by MAUT last November, and academic
freedom... Sorry, what was accepted as a principle by MAUT last November?
The six principles CAUT principles, okay? This is principle six. Academic freedom must not be confused with institutional autonomy. Post-secondary institutions are autonomous to the extent that they can set policies independent of outside influence. That very autonomy can protect academic freedom from a hostile external environment, but it can also facilitate an internal assault on academic freedom. Academic freedom is a right of members of the academic staff, not of the institution. The employer shall not abridge academic freedom on any grounds, including claims of institutional autonomy. The AAUCT statement, which is university endorsed, and which John himself has called strange, but has been has its number one principle, the number one point it deals with is institutional autonomy. Institutional autonomy there trumps other academic freedoms, freedoms of research, freedom of teaching, intramural rights, and extramural rights. And in the CAUT statement, the contrary is true. So that's basically just information points.
So just to sum up, the point was you were just providing us with detailed points about the CAUT. Let me finish. May I finish? I just want to get clear. So you provided us with details about the CAUT statement and the AAUC statement. Thank you.
And yeah, just trying to some. I think there has been some.
Thank you.
Some confusion.
John.
I'd just like to follow up on Bob's comments. He very nicely read out the CAUT portions that deal with institutional autonomy. What CAUT doesn't do is to not deny the existence of institutional autonomy, nor do they say that institutional autonomy is irrelevant to academic freedom. But they do warn that we can't confound the two, and we surely can't use institutional autonomy as an excuse for arbitrary action. And I think that's exactly what I was trying to express before. So the notion that I think we heard a few minutes ago, that we should simply focus on internal process, of course we should focus on internal process. But these two things, I mean, I can walk and chew gum at the same time. I can be concerned with internal processes, and I can also be alert to external infringements. And it seems to me these are both within our domain of concern, and we should make sure that we address both. So it seems to me it's a non-argument, this idea of internal processes versus external processes and institutional autonomy.
Andre?
I agree that they should both be our concern, definitely, and we can worry about them at the same time. But I think they're not both related to academic freedom. So the external pressures that we're discussing, whether they be from funding agencies setting research priorities or international partners, as Nicole has discussed, archaeological research, which I face all the time, obviously, they constrain what we can do. They constrain what we can get money for. They constrain whether we get permission to do something. But I don't see them as constraints on academic freedom. We can produce whatever we want in terms of ideas, in terms of research results. People don't have to buy what we're producing, right? We can't force people to support what we want to do. I think academic freedom has to do with what is happening within the institution. As long as I'm not getting punished, as long as I'm not getting disciplined or denied tenure or an office or something, resources that everybody else has, for saying something, then I'm not, my academic freedom is not being infringed. So we have to be very careful also not to overreach in our claim of academic freedom in terms of public perception. Also, if we say, well, academic freedom is just basically the public giving us a blank check, the public who pays our bills, and so, I don't think we'll get anywhere with that. If we focus the discussion of academic freedom on our own internal context and then think about the rest of the constraints as an advocacy problem, basically. The university administration and us as a faculty trying to convince people that what we do is important and they should support it. That's not a question of academic freedom, that's a question of public and social advocacy. So I think it is important to separate the two levels, but we also have to worry about both.
So, please, and then I'm going to put myself on the speaker's list, please.
It's
okay,
I'll wait.
Sorry. You go next, I'll go.
Tony Whitehead in chemistry. I'm a bit depressed by the whole meeting because it seems to me that you have to fight for your own academic freedom. And luckily, until recently at this university, it was very easy to do. And you could fight your chairman, you could fight your dean, you could fight the principal if you wanted to. You had the academic freedom to do it. Ever since I started the University of London, I've had to fight for my own academic freedom because the people who are supposed to protect me always had their own agendas. I worked on the MAUT for years, and I spent most of my time smashing my fist down on the table because they were so terribly afraid to do anything. Well, I retired. So after I retired, I decided to go on doing research. So the chairman said, why do you want to do research? You should retire. And then he took my office away, and he took my books away and asked me why I needed books. And I said, well, I can still read. Another problem which I find is that too many emails go around, which nobody has ever even thought out what they're really saying. They're all single-spaced and usually written in atrocious English. And so I suspect that if you're going to defend academic freedom, you need a good hard copy somewhere to show to somebody. Then, after retirement, I got my NRCs, and these were very good. After all, you retire and they still give you an NRC, you do research, you publish papers, everything goes fine. Then you do it again. And then suddenly you hit this new system whereby the forms are very peculiar. You have to say you've got highly qualified people, but you fill up the highly qualified people and you find they've all been highly qualified in the wrong bits, so they don't count enough box tops for you to get the enough score to get the money to do any more training. Then you get another committee on the top which tells you very bluntly that you haven't done any... There's no idea that... They have no idea that what you're going to do in the next year, because you didn't tell them what you're going to do day by day. You have no idea what it's going to do in 5 years because they don't show how you're going to get the result which they want you to get, not knowing, of course, that if you knew it wasn't research, and if you do research and you hit that particular thing, you've cheated because no research always goes in directions you don't expect. That, of course, is why it's worth doing. And so now you go out and get money from outside. And so along comes a man, and he says, look, I'd like to buy your computers because I need to find out something about what goes in on boilers. So finally, you shake hands and you do it. And after you've got all the results, he calls another meeting and tells you you can't publish the results because he needs them to make his company make a profit, which was not mentioned at the beginning. And so I did what any academic would do and told him to take the computer away. I don't need the computer. Without the computer, which I've cleaned, he doesn't have the results. It's very interesting that a week later he saw my point of view. So what I say through all of this is that fight for your own academic freedom. It doesn't matter what it says in regulations, anybody can distort those. Right? MAUT for years had salary increases and then decided to give what were called merit increases. Do you know how many chairmen cheated how many chairmen used them against their young, older staff, saying, oh, you don't need them, you've got a big salary, we have to give them to the younger people. Of course, it wrecked your pension. They never told you that. So you have to fight them. There isn't any academic freedom you don't fight for. And so it doesn't matter what regulations we draw up, they can be used against you if they want to use them against you. You've got to stay on your own toes and fight for your own needs. And the librarians should have fought by their own needs by withdrawing their services if necessary, or putting all the books on the wrong shelves. Right? When they gave me a lecture room that was too small, with too small a screen to do my lectures, I wrote on the walls. They soon gave me a room with enough. Right? Come on. You have to defend your own freedoms. And what Peter McNally said, if you look at the way in which the interference in the university was done by the donors, nevertheless, the professors who worked under those conditions managed to do exactly what they wanted. And I think if we're not intelligent to be able to pull the wool over the eyes of the people giving us the money, we're in trouble.
Thank you. Darren, go ahead.
It's interesting to hear that, John, you say that you think that point six in the CAUT statement actually does strike the right balance between academic freedom and institutional autonomy, whereby institutional autonomy is assigned a position that is never to trump, certainly not to be conflated with, and never to trump academic freedom, even as it kind of establishes the institutional context in which academic freedom is distinguished from other kinds of freedoms in the public sphere, and even as institutional autonomy gives the institution something to appeal to in its attempts to shield itself from the predations of external agents. If, in fact, you think that balance is correct, and that's reflective somehow of what the MAUT leadership thinks, then my question is why wouldn't MAUT, if in fact it has not already, I may be ignorant on this question, but why wouldn't MAUT then simply push for a kind of vigorous endorsement of the CAUT statement on academic freedom and issue an equally kind of vigorous repudiation of the AUCC statement, which seeks, I think, pretty clearly to elevate the priority of institutional autonomy over academic freedom, and really kind of make a statement through MAUT on behalf of McGill academics that the kind of vigorous protection that the CAUT statement affords, that assigns clear priority to academic freedom without saying institutional autonomy is irrelevant and inconsequential, right? Why wouldn't MAUT make that kind of gesture, not only because it would seem that the CAUT statement accords with the balance that you've just suggested is the proper one, but also because that would bring to bear the kind of weight and history and size of CAUT as an organization, as an advocate and as an ally in exactly these kinds of fights that our colleagues have been talking about as being the kind of real stuff of where the defense of academic freedom takes place, regardless of whatever statement of principles you adopt. It seems to me that if the CAUT statement does in fact reflect the mix that you think is the appropriate one and kind of pushing for the recognition of that set of principles would also align us with CAUT as an ally in some of these extremely important fights, it seems to me that the path is clear.
Well, thank you for bringing the issue to the fore precisely that way. I want to know where this question of CAUT being divided from MAUT has come from. Jonathan invited his friend Kerry Nelson, and he immediately began to spread innuendos and, in fact, falsehoods about the division between MAUT and CAUT. Bernard can perhaps fill us in a bit more, but he briefly alluded to the fact that CAUT was founded here at McGill. We're full members of CAUT. our membership was there when the CAUT statement was approved and it was supported. And recently, pushed by such a point within council, we affirmed the CAUT statement. I look through the CAUT statement, I find nothing that I object to. So where would the notion come from that there somehow is a reservation or dissent on MAUT vis-a-vis CAUT? I just don't see where it comes from. The fact that AUCC came out with a statement that was obnoxious and was refuted by CAUT, it seems to me that whole debate played itself out as it should. I haven't heard anybody on the MAUT council or executive that supports the AUCC formulation at all. Certainly not the assertion that there were a whole series of aspects of institutional autonomy that would be used to trump academic freedom. That's obnoxious. Where would it have come from that this would be somehow attributed to MAUT? This is wrong.
Can I respond to that question?
It's false. I'm still speaking. Thank you. That's simply not well-founded. The idea, however, that there are aspects of the CAUT statement that don't cover some of the things we've been talking about here, I think is clear. And I'm sure anybody in CAUT would say, yes, we haven't really covered that. CAUT is a very broad-based organization. It's the dominant membership is not research institutions, and that's what we represent. And clearly, there are a whole set of issues that we have to be attentive to in addition to internal academic freedom. So that's my response. Yes, say a CAUT statement. There's no problem with that. In fact, it's very instructive, and I've learned quite a bit from it. But to make a statement on or a set of principles on academic freedom embedded in McGill so that it informs practice, in particular administrative practice and policy, seems to be as much merit.
I think that you asked why there's a sense that there's a division between MAUT and CAUT. I guess one reason there's that sense is because if you look at what Mike described as the difference in practice, there's a very clear division there. And Tony also mentioned how quiet Mott seems to be in his experience. And I guess more explicitly on precisely this issue, there was a motion put forward in council meeting this fall that MAUT endorse the CAUT statement on academic freedom, and it was rejected. So I would say that's you know, an indication that there's a division. So I guess.
If I could just intervene, that motion was trying to prevent the Committee on Academic Freedom from doing its work and from addressing the questions within McGill.
So let me then say another reason. Because you were asked specifically why does not MAUT endorse the COT statement, and you didn't respond to it.
It's so already been done. Did that.
When did
maybe
you?
Maybe y'all can speak.
This is, I think, I don't want this to turn into a private conversation. I'm happy to have it, but and this may not interest everyone. We're just about out of time. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to wrap it up, and if there are people who want to linger and go on in this conversation, I'm happy to stay here until 6 o'clock this evening. So with that in mind, but I don't want to keep everyone else here. I'm sorry?
Is the mic cut off? Because I think there was a mistake. The motion was passed, but it was also stated that motion was intended to block the committee. I'm the one who made the motion. The motion passed. It was seconded. So you're suggesting that MAUT Council tried to block the committee? And you asked an earlier question, John.
I'm sorry.
But John had his freedom of speech.
We'll bring this to a close, and if you want to continue, we can continue the discussion. I actually brought a copy of the motion with me, but this is an internal debate. I'm happy to have it in public. This is not what the forum is about. So I'm going to just wrap up the forum. People who want to stay and hear this debate are welcome to stay and hear the debate and hear Bob say whatever he'd like to say. So I'd like to thank everyone for coming. Very much appreciated. As I said, the original goal of this was to try to get
a broader perspective on concerns at McGill about issues pertaining to academic freedom, and we found this very helpful. We will be proceeding from here. The next step is that the committee will be drafting a statement on academic freedom, which will take to the MAUT Council, and then it will be brought to the general membership in accordance with the resolution that was passed in November. And we'll be then proceeding from there. So let me thank you all for coming and invite you to stay around for the post-game show that's about to happen in 2 minutes. Thank you.